Actor Charles Grodin died yesterday. He was 86. Known for his work in films like Midnight Run, The Heartbreak Kid, Beethoven, and The Great Muppet Caper, Grodin also performed on television, on Broadway, and hosted his own talk show on CNBC. We spoke with him in 2012, and we aired that interview today in memoriam. The conversation begins with Grodin explaining why it's so difficult to thrive or even survive in show business.
The amount of rejection is so overwhelming that most people just can't handle it. I knew somebody who starred in an off-Broadway play. She was really outstanding. She got rave reviews. A major agency took her around, introduced her to everyone. At the end of the day, they said, "We don't feel you're a commercial type," and she left the business after that. And then at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, there was a young woman named Kathy Madigan, who was quite beautiful, as beautiful or maybe even more so than Audrey Hepburn, and so gifted, I never saw her. So this, and there's a number of names that just stayed in my mind because they were so good, but what they couldn't do is it's endless rejection, just endless rejection. In fact, the first book I wrote, I was making a movie in London in 1974, and I was waiting with Candace Bergen, the leading lady, in a hall. We were shooting in a castle, and we were just sat in a room off the castle. They were setting up the cameras and the lights, and a woman opened the door and said, did someone ask you to wait in here? And I said, no. And she said, it'd be so nice if you weren't here. And I, being who I am, I used that as a title for my first book, which became a bestseller. And it's all about having to deal with these objections. And I mean, rejections. Not only that, but the people in charge are not necessarily qualified, but it doesn't stop them for a moment from giving you all this advice. One top executive at then was called the William Morris Agency. He said to me, if you haven't made it by the time you're 30, then I would consider another profession. Now, I had already been in two Broadway hits, and I was guest starring on television in many, many shows. I was working consistently, but I made $3,000 a year for the first 10 years. So when he said, if you haven't made it by the time you're 30, you should, you know, consider some getting into another field, I chose not to tell him. I was 32, and then a few months later, I was in Rosemary's Baby. So you not only do you have all this rejection, but you're surrounded by people who are all-knowing, who just, no one's all-knowing. Of course, you have it everywhere. There are people everywhere that will tell you everything, you know, in government, out of government, every profession. I once had a doctor want to operate on me for a brain tumor, and I went to another doctor, had an MRI, and I didn't have a brain tumor. So you have to have a really thick skin and just be determined to keep going, and that's what I did.
You make the point very early in the DVD that you, and this is something that went back to your childhood, but you were brash enough to ask questions. You would actually go to Uta Hagen, and she would say something about the imaginary suitcase, and you would question her.
Well, you know, and I've never when I've done Johnny Carson, David Letterman over the years, I'm doing a comic bit where I come on and I always have some kind of problem or I'm annoyed by something. And the reason I do that is I don't really have the confidence to just come on and say, well, I just finished a movie and it was a lot of fun and he was a lot of fun and she was a lot of fun. And I mean, it just, so I usually come on with a real, real problem. But I'm not, in life, when people meet me, they're kind of taken away. I'm not a wise guy. So when I was 10 years old and I was actually impeached as the president of my fifth grade class by the teacher for asking so many questions. I'm big on asking questions, but I don't mean them to be a wise guy. As I recall at that time, it was, why do we have to walk single file, no talking? All the classes changed at the same time. Well, that was considered aggressive and rude. But I didn't mean it. I didn't know that. And then by the time when I went on to high school, I would ask I was the valedictorian of my class, and I thought if I didn't understand an economic theory, for example, an economics class, I would ask the question. I kept getting kicked out of class, even though I was the president of the class. So the principal would say to me, I never know if you're here to discuss class business or if you've been kicked out again. But the reason I'm saying all this, I did not, when I asked Uta Hagen, why are we carrying imaginary suitcases and opening imaginary windows, I was sincere. I thought that there was going to be an explanation about this, and I did not mean to, I'm just not a wise guy. Well, she despised me. She took it as though I was taking a shot at her, which I just simply wasn't. And by the time I got to Lee Strasberg, I decided not to ask him why we are taking imaginary showers. Because in my experience, this has got absolutely nothing to do with being an actor. And ironically, after I left Udahagen, after 3 years there, she dropped those exercises.
It is fascinating to me that you lasted 3 years, though, because you referred to her as a bully in the DVD.
She was a bully, and particularly toward me. I mean, she would make fun of me when I was actually doing the very thing that you're supposed to do, which is try to make an acting situation, make it real for yourself. And she would say, look at him working on his little personalizations up there. In other words, if you're supposed to love someone or whatever your feeling is, you try to imbue that person with someone that you do have those feelings for. You make a very good point. How could I have lasted 3 years? And I've asked myself that as well. I think it's part of the thick skin that I have, because what I did gain from these 8 years was that I was in front of, in her case, of a hostile person. I was getting up in front of Pittsburgh Playhouse. They were abusive. I mean, they would make fun of me in particular, because right around that time, Marlon Brando and James Dean and the Actors Studio was coming into prominence, and with the whole concept, to put it in simple language, you try to experience the role you're playing, and they of course had no idea how to do this. And when I would ask about it, you know, their defense was to make fun of me. Look at him; he's trying to live the part. Look at him up there. Of course, none of these people ever made a living. In fact, no teacher I ever had ever made a living acting. And that's true today as well. Maybe way back when some did, but no one that I ever ran into. In fact, ironically enough, Lee Strasberg himself, who was in at least one of the Godfather movies, he himself was critical of his performance, saying he was too camera conscious. So what I'm saying is none of it had anything to do with imaginary suitcases or opening imaginary windows or taking imaginary showers. But the value of the 8 years, I still would be for people going to class. I think it would be best if the teachers just let them alone. And one woman, I was looking around when my son was considering doing this, and I asked this one woman I knew who was teaching, and she's telling me what she does, and then she says, and then I asked the students their opinion. Well, that's deadly. I mean, the students are not in a position to criticize. In other words, they're just going to crush your confidence. And I think what's different about me, and I'm not sure where it came from, is I'm somehow able to take criticism and just move on by, because I've just heard it my whole life. And in 1974, I did a movie, and the critic for Variety said it would be sad to think an acting career lay ahead. And the next year I won a Best Actor Award on Broadway. So it's the perils of show business is really, it's kind of cautionary tale, and the subtitle is Proceed at Your Own Risk, that you should understand what you're getting into, and that very few people will make a living, and it really has almost as much to do with your resiliency as it does with talent. If you can't take the hits, and I think maybe one of the ways this might be helpful to people is understand that the people taking these shots at you, they never made a living acting. When my son did go to, I sought out the top teacher in New York, and made a phone call, and I got him in there, and he wasn't communicating very much with me, which is not unusual. And at some point after a few months, I said, what are you doing there? Are you doing scenes? He said, no. I said, well, what are you doing there? And he says, we're reciting poetry. I said, uh-huh. Then the teacher called me at some point and said, you know, he really should take a movement class. Well, that's another thing. I mean, you must take a movement class if you want to be a dancer. But you could be an actor without taking a movement class. And ironically, my son, who was told to take a movement class, he was an all-state AAU basketball in Connecticut, went to the national finals. And he's quite athletic and, frankly, doesn't need a movement class.
You
all the things.
You had a successful career in film. You had a successful career on Broadway, but in 95, you really did switch gears. Were you sick of acting?
No, it wasn't so much that. It was that I thought it was appropriate that I be home with my son, because up until that time, my wife and my son would travel around. I mean, I had 18 locations when I made the movie Midnight Run, and he was going to start school, and I just thought it would be a better idea that I be a stay-at-home dad. I once told David Letterman this, and he said, "How did your son feel about that?" And I said, "He didn't like it." But I just thought it's a better idea, and I always did have an interest way back. As early as maybe 15 years before that, I was like a regular guest with Tom Snyder, who had a show on CNBC, which I eventually, when he went over to CBS, I took over that show. And I always had an interest in political things and just the overall the things go. Like now I'm a commentator for CBS Network News, and I broadcast from home. I found a way to just, it's commentary, it's not a radio show. And I have 2 million people across the country who listen to these commentaries every day. So it's an incredible privilege, and I write a column for the New York Daily News website each week. And primarily, I'm not sure, well, I guess when I started the cable show, I became aware of certain things like the Rockefeller drug laws in New York and the felony murder rule in America in general. And I got very interested in that and eventually became an advocate for inmates and was able to get a number of people released.
You know, you talked a moment ago about when you would go on Carson and Letterman,
right,
and the role that you played in that.
Yeah.
But that was a performance. But so many people knew you from that.
A lot of people knew me from that. And the people who knew me the best, they would be very, very uncomfortable when I would do that because, you know, I did it pretty convincingly. Convincingly enough that people became nervous. What happened about 5 years ago, I contacted the Letterman people and said, "You know, I really can't come on again because I'm dealing now, because of being an advocate with a governor, with a senator, or even with press people who will call me." And more than one person has told me that they were a little nervous about calling me because they thought they were going to run into that guy on Carson or Letterman who might be, you know, very rude and but so unless you knew that it was a comedy bit, you know, you would think, well, this guy's got to be the most unpleasant human being I've ever... I mean, one time I actually came on and acted as though I didn't know the camera was on me as I was walking onto the stage. I turned around, I yelled off stage, "I was told I'd be paid before I came out here." You know, well, to me, it's just jokes. But if you don't know that, you'll think, oh, my God, this guy is just...
But you have to have somebody to play along with you.
Well, the hosts always knew it.
I mean, the great thing about Carson was that you had a great sparring partner there.
Initially, I was on, it used to be on until 1 a.m., 11:30
right,
to 1 a.m., and I was first on at 6 minutes to 1, and then 9 minutes to 1, and then, amazingly, somebody called from the show, and he wanted to put me under exclusive contract as a guest, which I was. Then eventually, I got to be too much for him. He denied it later because we became friends after he retired, where I was banned not from the show, but from when he was hosting. So I'd be on with guest hosts like Bill Cosby or David Steinberg or Joan Rivers or people like that. And he would watch, and then he had me back on. And once during a commercial break, he said, "You know, I never knew what to do with you, but now I see I can do anything with you." I said, "Oh yeah, I'm just kidding around." And then I was fortunate in the last 15 years of his life to become friends with, I don't know if you're old enough to remember Jack Parr.
Sure.
And he would often say to me, I don't know if I would have known what to do with you." I said, "Oh, you would have handled it. You know, if you know, I'm kidding."
Well, you see, you would think, I would think you would be the perfect Jack Parr guest.
Well, I mean, I think so. I mean, as long as he understood,
yeah,
that this is a joke, I'm simply joking. I mean, I was looking at something recently where I came out, and for some reason, when David Letterman was out with a health issue, I was the first guest host, and my guests were, the first guest was Julia Roberts, and the second guest was Regis Philbin. And I was sitting down on the steps, not behind the desk. Then Regis was the second guest host at another time, and he's behind the desk. And I made a reel to do about, why are you sitting up here? And I was down there on the steps. There weren't even any lights down there. Now, unless you knew, it was all true what I was saying, but the truth is I didn't care. I mean, it's just not an issue. I'm involved with too many, being an advocate for inmates, and I'm a mentor to three autistic young men. You know, there are more important things for me to worry about than am I behind the desk or sitting on the steps. I just, you know, so it's all a joke to me. But if you don't know it, and I've become very wary about doing that right now. I mean, I mean, for example, right now, I'm not going to do it with you. How dare you ask me about the perils of showbiz? Didn't you look at the tape? You know, I mean, it's a joke.
It's an imprint of Hal Leonard, and it's out and about. And
yeah,
it's called,
and the value of it is, I don't think everybody should run out and buy this thing, but if you know anyone or anyone in your family who's considering going into show business, and it also deals with directing and writing as well, it reflects my experience, and all I can tell you to verify my experience, there were so many gifted people that I never saw again. And that kind of speaks for itself to me. And it was not lack of talent. It was just most people can't handle that kind of go away. We don't want you. We're not interested. And to me, even early on, before I had even developed into anything, I thought they were making a mistake. And I'm really like that today. Because I'm primarily do more writing than anything else. And if you don't, I've written three plays for New York, and they've all sold out. So if you don't want to do another play of mine, I think you're making a mistake. I mean, they've all sold out. What else?
Right.
Can I, what's your track record?
Well, that's a confidence you have in you and your work.
Well, that's exactly right. But it's very limited. I should tell this, Joe. My confidence in me and my work is very limited. I have no confidence in most things. Like I wouldn't know about most things. And I think it's because most things today are so, the way people express themselves, like if you try to follow, somebody was talking to me yesterday about how Paul, or it's Rand Paul, made a speech about the Fed, and she couldn't agree with him more. And I said, you understood all that? She said, oh, yes. Well, see, I don't. I didn't see the speech, but I don't even know what the Fed is. I know I've heard of the Federal Reserve, but I couldn't tell you what it is. And when my assistant says my computer has a fever, I don't know what that means. And God help me, I have to stop asking the plumber, so what happened down there in the basement? Because he'll answer me, and I won't understand it. So I have a limited knowledge, but I think I represent most people. I'm not talking about show business now. I mean, in general, most people have a difficult time understanding what people are talking about. Obamacare, I mean, it's very hard to understand what people mean. I can't follow it, and I've been a commentator for 16 years, and I would say I'm more than I'd say above average informed, and I just don't think it's not clear enough. It's not, they make assumptions that we know more than we actually do, and they're talking over our heads, and it's not a good idea when you're running for office.
And this is where the question, asking questions, comes in.
Yeah.
And is really relevant.
Yeah, but you've got to keep it simple and keep it coherent. Because most people have a particular interest, and it may not be about the Federal Reserve.
Shocking, isn't it? Yes.
Well, I mean, so now every time I start to ask a question, I say, now watch out, they're going to answer you, and you're not going to know what they're saying. So I'm trying to control myself now,
You're mellowing.
Mellowing, yes, trying to.
The late Charles Grodin speaking with us in 2012. The actor died yesterday at the age of 86. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.